WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The eccentric magic and comedy duo Penn and Teller have a new weekly variety show that premiered this month on the FX cable network. It's called Penn and Teller's Sin City Spectacular, and it's broadcast from Las Vegas, where they live. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from Penn and Teller. Penn and Teller actually don't like to be described as performing magic and comedy. They prefer tricks, cons, and swindles. Pretty amazing ones. Penn is the tall, husky juggler and card shark who provides the narrations, jokes, and verbal abuse. Teller is the magician who never speaks on stage. First, we'll hear from Penn in an interview we recorded back in 1987. He's described their shows as magic for people who hate magic acts. I asked what kind of magic he hated.
When people picture magic, they picture that kind of old guy in a tux pushing women in bad bikinis into boxes while playing, you know, Star Wars music or something. And there's a whole lot of people that would like what we do that wouldn't like the standard magic things. Was just the most important thing was to get that image of pushing women around out of people's minds so that we could do what we do.
In your shows, you sometimes make it seem like magic and juggling are a lot of showmanship. And then after you've told the audience that, then you really make it come alive and make it seem truly magical.
Well, I really believe that there's a philosophy in magic that is in really all of magic. There's a level of condescension. The I can do something that you can't, and the problem with that theory is that when you're doing the show, you have people in your audience that can do heart surgery and fix motorcycles. I mean, program computers. And I think that in no other form of performance do people come out and have that kind of chip on their shoulder. So we take for granted that every single person in our audience, when they were 12 or 13 years old, read one magic book and learned one magic trick and take that as a given. And I don't like that kind of Doug Henning coming out and saying, oh, just suspend all your disbelief and be children for a while. We don't want children in our audience. We want people to come with a real chip on their shoulder and knowing that what we're doing is swindling, because that's where the real fun of it is.
I'm sure a lot of magicians don't like you calling magic swindling and tricks. Do you get some negative reactions from some of the older magicians?
We try so hard to be bad boys, and we try so hard to make people like Harry Blackstone Jr. and Henning and Copperfield angry at us. But unfortunately, they're such professionals, and they're so good at what they do. I think they understand completely what it is we're trying to do. The only problems we've had, and we have had problems, has been with amateurs. Because they read the books and they take rules that are simply learning tools and act like they were moral rules.
Magicians and jugglers frequently wear, you know, capes and hats, and there's this whole costuming for that profession. And you guys started off performing, well, you would wear T-shirts and jeans, as I remember, mm-hmm. and Teller used to wear tights.
Yeah.
And now you both wear three-piece suits, which I can't think of anybody else who's ever worn three-piece suits in a magic kind of show. Well, how did you get the idea to dress that way?
There's a fascinating piece of history that ties in with this. When you picture the standard magician, you picture top hat and tails. Now, the reason you picture that is in the late 19th century, when magic was really flourishing. In Europe, a magician got the brilliant idea that what he was going to do was to dress just like his audience, which at that time was top hat and tails. And then years went by, and all the technology of magic was built around how you can hide a bird inside the tails of a tailcoat. And magicians held on to that, and the basic idea behind it was completely lost. Teller and I decided that it would put more emphasis on us and what we were doing. And after all, the show is Penn and Teller, and it is unabashedly about us, if we took away anything people could hold on to. So we're wearing the clothes that are the closest, if not to our audience, then the closest to invisible. It makes people have to deal with us. They can't say, oh, that guy's wearing a sweater. That's the kind of guy he is. You know, he's wearing this kind of clothes. He's a Robin Williams kind of guy. He's wearing a leather jacket. He's a Bruce Springsteen kind of guy. You can't do that at all with a suit coat. And also the fact that I think that with our difference in sizes, the fact that we're dressed identical always makes me smile. It's kind of a monkey's thing happening there, you know. Mm.
In a cable special that you and Teller did, you ran your own magic store. That's how the story started. And I wonder if you still hang out in magic stores a lot, if that's still as much fun as it used to be.
We do go occasionally. I never hung out that much. Teller did very, very much in his youth. And what we had felt every time that a magic store was portrayed on television or in movies, it was always portrayed as a very mystical, wonderful Tinkerbell-type place. And the angle we wanted to give to it, which I think is the wonderful angle, is essentially a magic store is some old guy ripping off children. And the magic store had never been, I had never seen one in a movie or television that was dirty. But Invisible Thread is a little bit of a love letter to the cheesy, sleazy guys that really run those magic stores. And the nice thing was the magic store that Teller hung out in, which was a magic store in New York that he hung out with when he was a kid, the man who owned it came to see Invisible Thread. Teller invited him to the screening. And afterwards he said, you know, that's just what I do. You guys really nailed it, you know? That Copperfield does this trick. I use that line all the time. It was just wonderful that he recognized what we were really trying to do. And so I think that I've unfortunately outgrown it a little bit. And also I can't go into a magic store and be taken anymore. And that's what I liked most about it. So I guess the answer is, in actuality, I don't really visit magic stores, but in my head, I do an awful lot. I have wonderful fond memories of that cheesiness.
Penn Jillette recorded in 1987. He and his partner Teller have a new weekly variety show on the FX cable network. We're going to hear an interview recorded with Teller last year. Teller not only performs incredible feats of magic, like staying in a water tank longer than Houdini, he brings grace and intelligence to his art. On the other hand, he performs a lot of very funny magic intended to satirize all the cliches of the form. Teller doesn't speak on stage, and he used to refuse to do interviews. I asked him why he's become more comfortable speaking in public about his work.
Over the years, we've grown to trust our audience more. It used to be that when I was in the lobby, I would stay silent after the show. And then it gradually dawned on us that the entire audience knows perfectly well that I can talk. And it was kind of a, it was kind of a sign of respect to when they said, "And we enjoyed your show," to say, "Thank you." And that's been extending over the years, and to the point where I've done print interviews for a long time. And then I started to do little pieces on NPR on All Things Considered. Now here I am with you.
How did you start not talking in your performances?
The first I remember not talking was when I was actually about maybe 10 or 11 and going out for Halloween. And I discovered that if I didn't talk, people never recognized me in my Halloween costume. They always recognized my voice, which was very distinctive to them. You know, I mean, what is 10 people on the same street? Of course, they're going to recognize my voice. And then, as I began to work more in theater and magic, I became really interested in plot, and I started to pay attention to what magicians usually said. And what they usually said was things like, "Here I have a red ball. Now I'm placing it into my left hand. And now, lo, it is gone." All stuff that the audience could see for itself. So it became obvious to me that there ought to be a level of any piece of performance, especially any piece of magical performance, that people can perceive by watching it. So I thought this was a kind of an interesting challenge because nobody was doing it at the time at all. And I began to work on this with a college drama professor of mine. I went to Amherst College, and I conned the drama department into doing a course called The Figure of the Magician in Dramatic Literature. Right, right. You know, this is Teller works on his magic act with a pretty cool drama professor. And we worked on several pieces that were silent. I then tried the silent stuff at the fraternity parties and found miraculously that if I had gone in and started to try to shout down the crowd,
yeah,
you know, I would have been heckled to death. Go in, don't say a damn thing, shine spotlight, little spotlights on you, turn off all the other lights in the room, and lo and behold, the frat boys would momentarily remove their hands from their girlfriends' breasts, set down their cups of beer, and pay attention.
Now, since you didn't speak in your performances, since you don't speak in your performances, were you ever afraid you'd be confused with a mime?
Well, mimes generally don't use props, and mimes generally have their faces painted white and behave much like a piece of sugar candy. And I don't think anybody's apt to confuse me with that because, among other things, I'm very unconscious of exterior manifestations of what I'm thinking. That is, I don't think about making faces. I don't think about holding positions. And mime is sort of more akin to dance in that, you know, where people do think about their postures and the shapes they're making. I just think about the evil thoughts I'm thinking. and that's how I work.
You have evil thoughts in your head when you're performing?
Oh, very often, yes.
Like what?
Well, in the show, you know, one of the things that I've done for the longest time is to slash a rose to bits by cutting its shadow apart. There's a sort of a white paper screen and a rose in front of it and a little lamp. And the lamp casts the shadow of the rose on the screen. And wherever I slash through the paper of the screen, the corresponding portion of the rose withers and dies. There are very evil thoughts that go through your head when you're doing that. The punchline to that, which I'm very proud of because not that many pieces of magic have a good twist at the end, is that I accidentally prick my finger with the knife. And when I'm holding my hand out to look at the wound, the shadow bleeds. There's lots of evil thoughts around that.
Now, tell me more about why you got into this kind of malevolent side of magic, thinking evil thoughts with magic. Because magic, for a lot of people, is just this kind of pure delight and, you know, very kind of joyful and...
Insipid.
Yes, right. Yes.
Joyful and insipid or fraudulently mystical. I like drama. I like drama. It's very simple. And I always have. The things that have attracted me have never been frivolous sorts of comedies. You know, the things I like. My favorite movie is Psycho. My favorite play is Oedipus Rex. My favorite Shakespearean play is Macbeth. My favorite short story writer is Poe. That's just me. I don't know that. I pulled magic in that direction so much as I was pulled in that direction by those desires. And I've found a curious thing, which is that the darker the thought that I'm thinking, the funnier the audience finds it.
Uh-huh.
It reminds me of the Curse of Cassandra. I think Apollo came down and offered to make love to Cassandra, the Greek maiden. She turned him down. And he cursed her, and the curse was she would always make correct prophecies, and no one would ever believe her. And that's kind of the way I feel when I'm thinking the darkest of thoughts, and the audience is laughing its head off, and I'm happy though.
My guest is Teller. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition, we're listening to an interview I recorded last fall with Teller of the magic and comedy team Penn and Teller. We spoke just before their TV special, Home Invasion. I asked Teller about one of the tricks on the show. One of the things you do is you get into the water tank. This is something you've done on stage, but in this show, you're doing it in a family's living room. And do the setup for us. Describe what's happening in this.
Well, we have sent a family out of their house. We've gotten their consent to be on a television show. They don't know anything about what we're going to do. So we sent them out of their house and set up our lights and set up our water tank, which is a thing that looks like a phone booth full of water, in their living room. And it's an unpleasant-looking thing because I am inside the water tank, and I am locked in there with bars keeping me from getting my face to the surface of the water. We then draped this entire thing with a piece of fabric, so they just saw this red monolith in their living room, brought them back in, and sat them down. And Penn announced that he was going to do a little bit of close-up magic, something very un-Penn and Tellery, just a piece of close-up magic. But to keep the home audience interested, at which point he whips away the sheet, revealing me in the water tank, Teller, he says, will hold his breath until Penn finds the correct selected card. This is something we do on stage, and it's pretty effective. But putting it in somebody's living room and having them suddenly find a couple of hundred gallons of water in a large tank in the middle of their living room with a man holding his breath in a life and death situation is quite another
thing. While a card trick is being done.
And also in the theater, you know, there's something about the frame of a theater that makes you know that everything's going to come out just fine in the end. Well, when it's happening in your living room where real things happen, it has quite a different feel. And as the plot unfolds, Penn fails to find the card, but I insist on remaining in the water tank. And Penn acknowledges my heroic insistence to remain in the water tank, and then ignores me while I completely drown. And the thing ends up with Penn shrugging and basically telling the people that from now on it's a pretty easy trick, as this corpse is floating there in their living room, and leaving them in their living room with it's 4 or 5 people. With a large tank of water and Teller's corpse. And the final moments of the show are just very pleasant in watching these people trying to deal with the fact that they now have a corpse in their living room.
Which makes the trick even better because, of course, you're not dead, which means that you are under that water even longer than we could have ever imagined you'd be able to survive there. You've been under so long that you're forced to play dead to be credible.
It's exceedingly unpleasant to do.
I was going to ask you that, especially I should point out you're wearing a suit and tie, your standard, you know, theatrical garb, in that water tank. So in addition to what you must be going through with air, you know, you're wearing a suit and tie in there.
The suit and tie doesn't bother
nothing,
me very much.
Huh?
Nothing compared with the strain on my lungs.
Tell me what it feels like. I have no clue how you make this trick work.
Mm.
But whatever it is, I'm sure it's not pleasant.
No, it's not. It, if it were only the claustrophobia of being in that confinement,
it would just be like an MRI.
yeah. That would still be pretty unpleasant.
Yeah.
But I'm used to it now. You know, I've done that thing for 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
And I've grown comfortable with it, and all the physical things that I need to have good and strong and workable are very comfortable and workable now. When I first tried it, it was very strenuous. The first time we ever did it was on national television on Saturday Night Live, and there were serious problems that very first performance. And if you should ever see it in rebroadcast on TV, they do close-ups of my face, and my eyes look very full of anxiety, and they are very full of anxiety. Now, not actually full of anxiety over death. They're full of anxiety over embarrassment, because we never do anything that would actually risk my death or Penn's death. It's extremely important if you're going to do dangerous things to always have several levels of safety precaution on them. And in that particular one, on Saturday Night Live, there was a particular gesture that if I made this gesture, one of our assistants would run out, unlock the tank, and drag out my waterlogged body before I had a chance to drown.
You just tell me one thing about the water tank. How much of that really depends on you holding your breath for a long time? Or breathing in a most minimal way.
You're asking questions about how we're doing the trick? Is that what you're asking?
Do I get punished by the Magicians Union for this?
No, you don't. You just get reminded that a good piece of the pleasure in watching one of these things is wondering how real it is. You know, that's really an interesting feature about watching a magical performance. It isn't just wondering how it's done. It's wondering where reality leaves off and trick begins. That's one of the most interesting things, and it's one of the things that magic can teach. It's, you know, every kid goes through a magic phase, and they go through a magic phase when they're about 10. Did you not, at some point when you were 10, read a biography of Houdini?
I didn't.
You didn't?
No.
Well?
I think I had an uncle who took pennies and nickels out of my ear, and that was like, no way.
That,
I'm not going near this thing.
That may have been a product of I think when I was growing up, not all young women went through that. They now do. What happens is you get to about the age of 10 and you realize that maybe the Easter Bunny wasn't real, which means that maybe adults sometimes lie to you. And the power of prevarication is very attractive. And if you are a kid with good morals, you then say, "Well, I'm going to learn about this through art." And of course, the perfect form of art to do that with is magic. If you're a kid without morals, that's when you start shoplifting.
So, anyways, we're just going to let me wonder about
where that line is. We're going to let you wonder,
but not
without saying that. Magic seems to have a very useful function in society, and that useful function consists in making people realize that even when people are lying straight in their faces and saying, "I am lying," that they can still be fooled And that means that when they turn on their TV the next time and someone lies straight in their faces, someone dressed usually exactly like Penn and Teller in gray business suits, they view it with a little more skepticism, and that's a very salutary effect.
Your act has always been billed as magic for people who hate magic. Did I say something wrong?
Yes, actually. There are those who respond to it and who refer to it as the magic show for people who hate magic shows. But by and large, we don't call it a magic show, and for good and sufficient reason. Because when you say magic, what do you think? You think, you know, greasy guy in a tux with a lot of birds. And
wait. And
yes,
a semi-clad woman beside him.
Beside him, doing all the work. Very unflatteringly dressed, usually, or flatteringly dressed in the basest possible way. Doesn't it strike you very strange that feminists have not protested magic shows? You know, being that, what do we see in magic shows? We see women mutilated, right? We see women in subservient and debased roles. We see any woman brought on stage by a male magician is implicitly raped, by and large, you know. By and large, the actual attitude is, "Hey, honey, can I? Let's see, what's your name? Julie? Can I call you Julie? Sure. What time? You know, that kind of just horrendous joke. This is what people think of when they think of magic."
Taylor, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. What fun.
Our interview with Teller was recorded last year. Penn and Teller have a new weekly variety show called Penn and Teller's Sin City Spectacular on the FX cable network. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.